Hello, and welcome to the Easy Button, the show that manages to lose half the content we should record for you. Your hosts tonight will be James Prendergast and Taylor Boone as well, as usual. Unfortunately, I managed to mess up the actual recording, so we're only getting half the show that you should have had, I should say. So enjoy what is there. Hopefully it's up to the exciting standards we've set in previous shows. I do apologise for taking so long to get this to you. So what have you been playing then? Anything interesting?
Yeah, so I've been playing a game that actually has been released relatively recently, which I know will surprise and amaze some people who might be listening to the podcast. I've been playing this game called Distant Worlds. Distant Worlds is a game, is a space 4X game, where you are like the embodiment of a space empire, and basically you're responsible for expansion and exploring the universe and exterminating aliens, right? Part of the 4X, the tried and true 4X formula. but the thing that's interesting about Distant Worlds is it's a real time strategy game.
Okay, so like Sims, or
well, where Sims is more less about building an empire and more about building ships and fighting. Distant Worlds is more akin to like a Master of Orion type of game, where your primary responsibility is building an empire, and space battles are a secondary consequence of that, right? And you have to do a lot of exploration and there's a lot of treaty trade sorts of mechanics with other civilizations. And again, it's all real-time strategy. So when you're not paused, you can pause at any time and give orders and look at stuff. And actually, the game will help you out. Whenever you go to a screen to look at things, it will pause the game on your behalf. You're not feeling like you're going to miss anything while you're trying to find the perfect world to colonize. But it has some interesting mechanics in it. One is, I've never seen a game that is of this empire-building stripe, at least in space, that was a real-time strategy game.
No, me either. When you first said it, I automatically thought of Sims, but
right.
Sims doesn't have that depth.
No. And this has a lot of... The closest thing I can think of is this is a Europa Universalis game set in space. So time is always marching on, and things are always happening. Another interesting thing to help you manage this... is it has a lot of automation. So you can automate colonization, ship design, ship building, diplomacy. There's three different settings. One is just have the AI take care of it for you, or you can have the AI suggest things for you, or you can put it on manual, run everything yourself. The problem with running everything yourself is the game is huge. It's a vast game. The smallest galaxy that you can play in is 100 stars. And it's not like Master Orion, where a star is just a point and it's kind of abstracted the solar system into, a point on a map.
Yeah.
Every one of these stars has multiple planets, which each planet can have multiple moons. There's asteroid belts. There's nebulae that you can build research stations in. There's black holes that you can build research stations around. There's gas giants you can mine for gas to help fuel your fleet.
So this game, does it have distances and time time to travel to places?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Oh,
a star, you can travel relatively slowly, and when you're fighting space battles, you travel relatively slowly. But you can to go between stars, to zip around a solar system, like from one end to the other, you go a lot faster. But it still takes measurable amounts of time for you to get anywhere. So you may have your fleet at your home world, and one of your colonies gets in trouble. It's going to take time for your fleet to get out there and respond. So you have to design your defenses based on that sort of knowledge, right?
Yeah, you have to allow things to be able to survive like a siege kind of thing.
Right, exactly. Another interesting mechanic it has is it has this concept of state-owned ships and private ships. And private ships are fully automated. There's nothing you can do to control them. And basically the privates, the private sector is responsible for trading and it's responsible for developing the economy of your empire. And all you can really do as kind of the leader of the empire is influence by building colonies and building space stations, how the trade flows, but you can't directly impact that. So the AI will set up trade routes on its own and send ships, you know, and will build ships at your shipyards based on what it thinks it needs. So it builds large freighters or small freighters. And it has, I don't know, probably 25 or 30 different sorts of materials that it will trade back and forth to your colonies to generate wealth, which you can tax, right? So it's
can you choose the tax rates?
You can choose your tax rates, or you can have the AI automate it for you, which is pretty cool, right?
That is cool, yeah.
So you don't have to, you know. So what I tend to do is when I have a small empire, I'll be more hands on with things. But once it gets to a certain level, it's just, you know, it gets unmanageable for a human to really go through and. Unless you're like OCD or something, you go through and tweak all these little variables. Yeah. So you turn on the automation as you go. And so it's the AI, I'm sorry.
So no, go on.
So it's, it's really, the AI is actually pretty good. I haven't seen it really make too many mistakes. And I know we talked about this on a previous podcast where, you know, we have this kind of dissonance between what you want to do and what the AI wants to do.
Yeah.
This game actually does a pretty good job of letting you decide where to expand and how to expand and doing all the important stuff that you as an emperor of a space empire would want to be doing. And it handles a lot of the mundane stuff. And it scales pretty well such that once you get above a certain size, you can start turning on more automation and letting it handle, you know, tax rates, for instance, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it's been a lot of fun. It's taken a while. The one thing you have to do is you kind of, and I played a lot of Space 4X games. You kind of have to grow to trust the AI that the AI is going to not mess you up.
Okay.
Because it's very hard. Because most Space 4X games, you do everything. You decide what's researched. You decide what the tax rates are. You decide what the ship designs are. You decide what gets built where. This, you kind of have to take a step back because you can't do everything. And really, once you get into the game, you don't want to do everything. Right.
It sounds interesting. It sounds sort of like a simulation.
Yes,
in a broad sense.
It's of
the structure of a company. So when you're a small company and you're like CEO, you're very hands on and you manage all the different aspects. But as you become a larger company, you're more in charge of the direction and attitude of the company than the day to day running.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a very good observation. One thing that I noticed when I was playing, you know, yesterday was, that it reminds me a lot of like a city builder, right? So you kind of build these things up and then you watch it kind of go because you can see all your ships moving or all the private sector ships moving around. You see, you know, you'll get reports, you know, goods are getting traded and moved around and you can see your explorers go explore new things and, you know, certain parts of the map are labeled when you discover them. So like you'll find, you know, the Wasteland Nebula or whatever, and it'll show up on the map, which is pretty cool because it kind of gives you a sense of progress on discovering the map.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's very satisfying when you start to see your trade routes start to come together because it'll put dashed lines on the map where all the trade routes are. And you start seeing these ships go up and down these trade routes. It's pretty satisfying to see that. It's pretty cool. It's a lot of fun. It's a fun game. I haven't finished yet. I haven't gotten to an end game yet, so I'm not real sure how the end game is. And a lot of 4X games have traditionally failed miserably at the end game because once you get to a certain point, it's just it's not just Space 4X games. It's most of these sorts of strategy games. Once you get to a certain point, it's all mopping up, and that's not very fun.
No.
So we'll see how that goes. But so far, it's been really fun. I mean, like I alluded to before, the galaxies are huge. Huge. The biggest galaxy you can play on is 1,400 stars. Each one of which may have 10 or 20 planetary bodies in it.
If it's that big, what kind of graphical, requirements does this game need?
Seems pretty minimal. I mean, I haven't noticed any real problems running it. I mean, it's probably a hybrid 2D, 3D thing. The ships appear to be 3D, although everything is top down.
Okay.
But it looks like it's a lot of graphics. They've taken a lot of open source, not open source, that's not the word I'm looking for, but, free space graphics from the Hubble Space Telescope, and they've put them on dialogue boxes and things, which are kind of a neat touch because it gives a very spacey feel to it.
Mm.
And I'm sure they did that for cheap, but it's really a lot of fun.
Where did you get this game from? Did you get it on download only, or is it in the shops?
It was Matrix Games. Matrix Games download. Matrix Games is like a strategy war game specialty online store publisher, I guess. Publisher.
Okay.
Matrixgames.com. And I think it was $30, maybe $40. I'm a sucker for Space 4X, so, I've been kind of looking forward to this since I first heard about it late last year. And it's put out by a small New Zealand company called Codeforce, of all things. And I hope they've been pretty good about supporting it so far. Where they put out a couple of patches post release to help address a few things, and it sounds like they're working on another big patch to address a few other things. So I hope they really support the heck out of this because it's a lot of fun. I hope they sell a number of copies because this is a genre that everybody's been looking for the next Mew 2.
Yeah.
Forever, and I'm not saying that this is necessarily that, because it is quite deep and complex, but it's still a lot of fun. I mean, if you're into that sort of deep, complex simulation and you love Space 4X games, I mean, you can do far, far worse. And I've got a couple of far, far worses on my hard drive right now, but I can't say enough about it. It's just I keep finding things in the game that are kind of surprising. Like, I guess there's some sort of weird overarching story that you find fragments of every so often. So you let go and you'll discover a ruin and it'll have a data crystal in there that tells some story about something that went on in the past. But I've never, it's kind of interesting because it's kind of in the background and I've never put it all together to see what the whole thing is, right?
Okay, I see what you mean.
You find bits and pieces here and there, and it's kind of, I'm sure it's probably, grade C sci-fi nonsense, but
pulp fiction.
Yeah, very pulp. And, but when you see a little flash here and a flash there of that, it kind of adds a little more interest to the game, I guess.
Yeah, it gives you a little push to try and advance further.
Yeah, it's like a nice little touch. And there's a lot of little bitty touches, right? So there's pirates. You can go fight the pirates. And when when you find the pirate dens and you destroy them, people think better of you. All the empires, your approval rating goes up.
Okay.
And there's space monsters like out of Star Trek, and you'll have to, and they put them in because otherwise, unless you're fighting a war, your fleets don't have a whole lot to do. So now every once in a while, a space monster will go harass one of your mining colonies, and you have to go deal with that. So it's kind of interesting the way they interject certain play mechanics into the game that give you something to do while your economy is kind of running itself.
Yeah.
So it's, like I say, there's a lot of nice touches, and it's a pretty well-made game. It's very nice-looking. It's not, awesome by any means, but it's a nice-looking game. And one thing, and I probably could go on forever about this, but, one thing that I like that they put in is there's a button that you can click called the expansion planner, and there you can see what resources your empire needs, And then it gives you a list of all colonizable planets and what resources they have in them. So you can really try to tailor your colonization efforts to support your economy, which is kind of cool, right? Because most of the time it's like, well, it's colonizable, I'll just go colonize it. But here, you know, you want to really try to build your economy up, and you don't want to just colonize everything because, you know, colonies cost a lot of money until they become self-supporting. So you, if you colonize everything, you're going to go into the red, and then, you know, I had a game, you know, go that way, and it's not not a lot of fun when your economy's in the tank. So Distant Worlds, good game. Highly recommend it if you like that sort of game.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Okay, what have we got next?
All right, so a couple of retreads from past podcasts, but with just I have a couple of new things to say about it. One is I've been playing some Battlefield Bad Company. Two, I've been playing a bit more of that, and I think this will tie into our topic a little bit, because while I am like the world's worst Battlefield Bad Company 2 player right now,
yeah,
that game really is really addictive. It makes you keep wanting to come back for more because of all the little gifts they give you. So you play a map, kill a few dudes, die a lot, which is what I do, and they'll give you pins and medals and ranks and, you know, unlocks. And
you know, even though you're dying, yeah.
Even though you're dying, because it's point-based. So every time you kill something or you do something good, so, you know, one thing that you can do is you can spot an enemy. And if you spot an enemy and somebody kills that guy, you get some points.
Oh, cool.
If you heal somebody, if you're playing a medic, and you, once you are able to unlock the healing stuff, which is dopey as hell, but once you heal, when you heal somebody, you get some points. You know, when you're, if you're playing an engineer and you repair, you know, a vehicle, you get some points. So they're always kind of giving these points, kind of trickling into your character. And every so often the points will give you an unlock, or, you know, if you happen to be on a good squad, then the squad will, you know, if the squad does well, you get points for being on the good squad. So it kind of gives you all these little rewards that keep you interested in the game, even though you may be horrible at it. And so, you know, I'm horrible at it, but it just gives you enough. There's enough success there to keep you nibbling at it over and over and over and over again. And so it becomes quite addictive, because you want to get these little rewards, right?
Yeah.
You want to get, man, I only need 1,000 points to get my next rank, which means I get, you know, new unlock, right? I get a new shotgun.
It's like kind of combining like OCD and completionism,
yes.
I should say.
Yes. And there's a lot of completionists in the, you know, in the Battlefield Bad Company 2 community. There are people who are like, I hate playing recon. That's another class. But I'm going to play until I get all the unlocks. Like, well, why are you playing recon if you don't like to play it? But, you know, again, it's Pokemon. Pokemon, it's the Pokemon, outlook, right? Got to catch them all. Got to get everything.
Yeah.
Even if I don't enjoy doing it, which I'm not that way. I'm just happy to get something. And, you know, I'm real happy when our team wins, and I'm real happy when I die only twice as much as I, you know.
I'm glad you finished that part off, because it was like, I'm really happy when I die.
No, I'm happy when my kill to death ratio is 50% or higher. So 0.5 okay. or higher, right? So
yeah.
So yeah, I mean, there's not much more to say about it. It's a beautiful game. Game's, you know, kind of hard to play.
How are you finding it? Are they supporting it post-release, or what are they doing?
Yeah, they've done a number of patches. The game has a lot of problems, which I think is, I never played one of these games before, but I take it that this is a pattern with these guys with DICE.
Yeah, it's part of the course, really, yeah.
And so, you know, but they have released a number of patches that have addressed some of the problems with the game. But there's two things about the game that are just, in my mind, unforgivable in 2010. And one of them is the in-game chat, just the in-game voice comms don't work for diddly. They're horrible. And in a game where you're really trying, it's really about, you know, squads and teams trying to achieve objectives, not having voice comms in-game is pretty unforgivable design in this day and age.
Yeah.
And you know, especially Team Fortress 2, which is kind of the, you know, the bellwether for this sort of game, does it so well. To have a game that comes out that's supposed to be a AAA first-person shooter and do it so horribly is just drives me crazy. And the second thing, which again, I realize I am, you know, comparing it to Team Fortress 2 again, but the server browser's just an abomination. half the time you can't find a server, or it takes forever for a server to show up.
Oh, really?
Or, yeah, and the filtering's a little wonky. And, yeah, it's almost just slightly better than not having a server browser at all. You know?
What about, can you, like, bookmark favorites and stuff like that? So
you can bookmark favorites. And but even then, when you have bookmark favorites, it takes forever for it to go out and ping the server and see if it's up. And so it's just really, really slow and feels very clunky. And again, you look at Team Fortress 2, you know, their server browser, you know, it's pretty bare bones, but, you know, it's fast. It does the job.
Yeah.
And so this is, it's very, those things are kind of disappointing in the sense that this is a relatively big budget AAA sort of game, you know, that those two things are foundational things. It's not like, you know, the shotgun spread is off on one of the shotguns where it doesn't really matter that much. And this is pretty foundational when you're building this sort of game, and it's kind of unconscionable that they would have it be this poor. So, you know, but like I say, I'm playing it for fun. You know, I'm not ever going to max everything out, and that's okay. It's just a good time. Next game I've been messing around with some more is Dragon Age Online Origins Awakenings.
Hmm.
Not much else to say.
Have you completed it yet?
I have not completed it yet. It's fun. The story is fun. You know, building your keep up. I just let the cat out of the bag. Building your keep up is fun. You know, the quests are fun. But there's just kind of there's like some niggling polish issues that I wish that they had fixed. Like there's some texturing issues, geometry issues where you get stuck on things that you should not get stuck on.
Really? Yeah.
It feels like they had a date they had to hit, and they hit the date, but it could have used another couple of weeks, you know, another pass.
Okay.
But you know, it's still fun. It's a good time. And I'm going to finish that off here, hopefully in the next week or so. And, you know, wait for the next round of Dragon Age stuff, whenever that comes out. But, it's fun. I mean, if you like Dragon Age, it's, you know, it's more Dragon Age. It's quite a bit easier than Dragon Age was.
Is that because you're relatively higher level, is it? Or?
You are relatively higher level, and they really haven't brought forward any new enemies that challenge you, at least not that I've found yet. That, of course, you know, I'm probably about halfway, maybe a little bit over halfway through this expansion, but, yeah. But I haven't seen anything that has tested my party's mettle yet. Okay.
Sorry.
But, you know, like I say, it's more Dragon Age, and that's a good thing. And, like I say, some of the stuff some of the quests are pretty cool. You know, being the lord of a keep and, having vassals that are trying to stab you in the back is, always makes for a good time.
Sounds good.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. A lot of loot, a lot of good time. You know, that's about it. I mean, Team Fortress 2, always.
Yeah.
Left 4 Dead, always. But, yeah, nothing else really we need to say about that. Although I have been told that we need to talk more about TF2 by some of our listeners.
Okay.
But I won't oblige them this time.
No, I mean, unfortunately, I don't play it, so it'd be like a pretty one-sided conversation, I think.
You should play it.
I don't like it at all.
Don't you like it? How can you not like it? It's the perfect game.
No, it's not. It's the whole, I don't like the crits. I don't like the randomness. I don't like, I've never liked Valve's jumping mechanics in any of their games.
Don't jump then.
Don't jump. I don't like, yeah, I just think the crits really ruin it for me. I don't like how, you know, you can be one-shotted from, like, a punch or something.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean...
And also going into a game against people who've been playing for a long time, they've got all these bonuses and they've unlocked all these things, and it's not fun to me.
So that's a nice segue into what I think our topic is, which is, how you develop a community and how do you keep people interested in your game,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
How's that for a sec?
Sounds good, dude.
So Team Fortress 2, what you just said is not correct. The fact that you have all these the unlocks in Team Fortress 2 are not, they don't give unfair advantage to the people who have them because of the way the weapons are balanced. They're just, they're alternative weapons. They're not super weapons. So you see what I'm saying? See the distinction I'm trying to make there?
Yeah.
They're not better. They're just different. So, you know, as a matter of fact, most of the time I play with the standard kit for most of the characters that I play, most of the classes that I play, you know. And it's nice to have some of the unlocks that allow you to more tailor your play style to right, based on your unlocks. But, you know, you can be as effective or more effective with the vanilla weapons out of the box. And this is one thing that I think Valve has done a very, very, very great job at keeping the community interested and allowing new players to come in even 2 years into the cycle of this game, because the barrier to entry, skill aside, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's a skill level thing there. But if you're a new player and you know, and you like this sort of game, you can come in today and be an effective player without having any of the unlocks. And that's one of the really great things about how new people come in all the time, because there is no real mountain, right? Like Battlefield Bad Company 2, one of the reasons why I'm horrible is I'm level 5 and all these dudes are level 30. Well, guess what? I don't have any good stuff. And there's definitely a difference between the starting kit and the level 30 kit.
Yes.
But in Team Fortress 2, there is no difference between the guy who's, well, I should say there's no difference. There's no meaningful difference, except in terms of stylistic, I think, between a guy who starts off today and a guy who has all the unlocks, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that's one way that the Valve has made continue to make this game accessible to new people, is the people who've been playing forever, aside from the skill level, right, which there is a definite skill level differential, they made it easy for people to come in, because even, you know, the day one kit, right, the noob kit, is as effective as everybody, as all the unlocks. And all the unlocks do is let you play your class in a slightly different way.
Mm, okay.
For example, let's take a class that I play a lot of. It's Pyro, right?
Yeah.
Set people on fire. So the Pyro's kit, base kit, includes a flamethrower, right, that allows you to, does an air blast, allows you to, you know, put people who are on fire out and also blast people into the air, right? The alternative, the unlock for the flamethrower, is what's called a back burner. So basically what the back burner does is it does more damage when you're on somebody's back, setting them on fire, and you don't have the air proofing, but you don't have the air proofing ability at all. So what that means is the Pyro's, you can either play the Pyro as a frontline attacking class that can disrupt certain formations in the game, right, by using the air blast, or you can play the Pyro as kind of a sneak from behind, spy-ish sort of character, and take people from behind and burn them from behind, and get that damage boost, right?
Yeah.
But both roles are equally effective, right? They both have their place in the game, and every one of the classes is that way. And so again, that makes it accessible to new people coming into the game who've heard about this game, who've read the Gamers with Jobs forum that's 14 million pages long, and are interested in the game. And we've had some new people come in to the group that I play with relatively recently, and they come in and they're good players, and they're as effective as some of the people who've been around for a long time, even though the other guys have the unlocks. And so I think, you know, again, in order to keep interest in the game, you know, Valve has done some really great things. And I think, you know, a lot of developers could draw some lessons from Valve on how to make a game that has a long tail, like Team Fortress 2, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, another thing holding me back from getting it as well is, you know, as you pointed out, I'm not going to be able to play with crutches. I barely play with Gudges on Left 4 Dead.
Yeah.
And Left 4 Dead 2. It's just the time zone difference is just too big.
Yeah, and I can understand that. I mean, if I wasn't playing with Gudges, I wouldn't probably be playing it still.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can understand that. But
as you say, though, it's a good example of like of adding things to the game to keep players engaged. But do you have any examples of games where, you know, the base game will keep players engaged either on their own emphasis or, you know, just because of what's in the game already?
Well, I think there's a couple, you know, like there's different types of games. I think one game that lends itself well to keeping people coming back, right, is, you know, this sort of ad hoc strategy game, right, like Civilization IV.
Oh, yeah.
Or, yeah. You know, Europa Universalis 3 or Master of Orion. Because of the randomness, you're never playing the same game the same way twice, even though if you played enough, you have your certain go-to strategies that you may start off in a certain way. But because the worlds are new every time and you start off with this level of exploration and you're discovering what the maps are, that keeps it fresh and that keeps people coming back in. Whereas games that tend to have a narrative, games that have narrative tend to be a one playthrough sort of thing, right? You've seen pretty much everything. There's not much else to see. And even games that have that narrative that try to make you come back, at least for me, tend to fail, right? So for instance, I'm trying to think of a good example that I can personally speak to. Well, you play Resident Evil 5, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So that's a game, I didn't play it, so I can't speak to it, but maybe you can, where you finish the game, and then you can start the game over again with all of your weapons.
Yes, you have the new game plus, yeah.
Right, is that interesting to you? Would you do that?
Yes, I did. I did actually start doing that, and then I just wanted to see what it was like more than I felt a compelling need to play through the game again. It's not really the type of feature that keeps me engaged in the game, though. It's probably my own personal preference. I mean, some people do like that.
Well, some people do, and I think it's an interesting way to try to do that. But but it seems to me that a Resident Evil style game is more about the story than the combat, right? You're there to see what happens to these people in this situation, right? Well, I think for a lot of people, I mean, because that's the style of game it is, right? It's a narrative.
Yeah.
It's a narrative combat game.
It's a closed system, isn't it?
It's a closed system. And so there's no... Going back and playing it again with better weapons just means you're going to play through the stuff you've already seen once faster.
Yeah.
And to me, I don't see how compelling that is, right? How useful that is to do. So, I think games that are narrative, right, tend to be one-time through games. There's not a whole lot of reason to go back. Like Bioshock. Love Bioshock. Why would I ever play it the second time, though?
I tried, it was horrible.
Right? Yeah.
I know, it's funny, isn't it? I think there are three types of games, though, that we can kind of broadly say
help to
keep you, the gamer, engaged and coming back. There's ones where the developer has input, like you mentioned with TF2. There's ones where the community have input, like I think you have two examples, like Morrowind.
Right, yes.
With lots of community mods to improve the game and keep it current and keep it expanding.
Right.
And then there are games, and they are few and far between, where they themselves have aspects to them which keep certain types of gamers coming back to them. So I suppose, Resident Evil 5 and the New Game Plus, and other games like Chrono Trigger and stuff like that with the New Game Plus.
Right.
People will go back and play those over and over again to get different endings, to get different, bonuses and stuff like that. Especially now with things like the game points on Xbox Live.
All right, achievements.
Achievements, with achievements
and
now.
And trophies, right? Yeah.
Yeah, like playing through games more than once tends to get you those achievements.
Right. Yeah, and achievements are a good systemic way to make people go back and play the game again, or at least play parts of the game again to get those achievements. There are certain OCD completionist type people who really live for that sort of thing and will play the game multiple times in order to get, you know, 1,000 points for the game, right? Which is the maximum amount you can get for an Xbox achievement for a game.
Yeah.
You know, not really my cup of tea, but I can see where people would be interested in doing it that way. But to me personally, that feels very artificial, right? It's like I've played through the game. I've seen everything. I've gotten as much out of it as I'm going to get out of it. Do I really want to go back and try to get, you know, this impossible thing that I will probably never, ever get anyway because I'm a horrible player just to get 10 more achievement points?
No. And I mean, but there are other methods that certain developers do use.
Right.
Like one, for example, and this is a very niche subject, really, but it's one that I immediately thought of when you mentioned this to me the other day, is Legend of Zelda. And there was this big thing about, as apart from the fact that like, things like the writing in the game, you can, up until, I think it was Twilight Princess, it was all in like kanji and stuff like that, and you could actually work out what the words were and what they actually said in real world languages, and they switched over to English language then, so I was able to kind of work out what all the signs said in Hyrulean.
Oh, okay.
In English and stuff like that.
That's
so kind of yes, like there are certain people out there who like to be able to delve into the game and discover things like that.
Yeah.
And there's also in the specifically in the Zelda games, there was a whole thing with the timeline. Uh-huh. I don't know if you're aware of this. Like in Ocarina of Time, there was effectively two endings, one in the future and one in the past. And there was this whole thing about how where all the games fit on the timeline, like which game was first and which game was last, and whether the timeline was split in two, there's a parallel universe going on, or whether it was just one timeline and whether things were all messed about. And there was like massive debates and, you know, people going through games looking for clues and stuff like that. And I always think in single player games like Ico and Shadow of the Colossus, where the narratives are very focused, but the world has its own narrative, which is separate from the narrative of the story.
Right.
And I think those games have a lot of value for people who don't necessarily want to get involved with online aspects.
Sure.
Like looking for mods or going, you know, playing multiplayer games and stuff.
Well, I remember playing Ultima 4 and 5 were that way for me, and 6 to a lesser extent, going and just poking around the world and forget about all the other stuff. Just going and poking around the world was, you know, in some ways more interesting and kept me playing that game longer and more often than just kind of trying to power through the main quest lines because there's so much interesting things to see. I mean, I did a similar thing to what you described with Legend of Zelda, where in Ultima everything was in runic, right? They had the text was runic, right? And I would go write everything down and decode it.
Find the Futhark.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was awesome and nerdy, but very awesome. So, and actually, you know, in a game like Oblivion, I spent most of my time just kicking around and trying to find, you know, cool sunsets and interesting, you know, there's just a ton of interesting little spots there. You know, you could argue that the main quest is kind of
pathetic.
Okay, that's a good word. not the word I was going to use, but that'll work. But just going and climbing this next hill and seeing the cool trees and watching the sun go down and watching the moons come up, that's pretty cool. I mean, that's a lot of fun.
And that was the biggest disappointment for me in Oblivion. And possibly even really, not so much Morrowind, because it was more fleshed out. But in Oblivion, there were all these temples and there were all these things underground you could find, but there was no point to them.
Yeah.
There was no overarching kind of world narrative that brought them all together.
Right.
There were, you know, these things happened in the past, but then there was nothing in the game that was kind of to link them all together. They just were just there. Because they were cool. Just because they were cool.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree with you. I agree with you there. I mean, that's one reason why Morrowind is, in a lot of ways, a better game than Oblivion, because it was a smaller scale and much more focused.
Yes, right? I think so.
And so everything there felt like it had a purpose, whereas a lot of stuff in Oblivion felt like it was just there just because, right? Which is just because is a bad reason to do anything, right?
yes.
So, but you know. You know, I think we touched on something. I actually made some notes on the subject. You know, when we talk about achievements, I think one thing that keeps people engaged is hearing the developers talk about the game. right? People like to know why things are the way they are. And whether it's on a developer blog or they go and do a bunch of podcasts or whatever, I think people who get into a game like to hear the developers talk about why certain decisions were made, why things are done this way. You know, BioWare's done a pretty good job of this with Dragon Age and Mass Effect to Mass Effect 2. And the Valve guys are masters at this sort of thing where, you know, they come out and they'll talk about, you know, design decisions and, you know, they have the developer commentary in the games. And I think that really, you know, kind of lifting the curtain slightly makes people
more involved
with it. Yes, they feel like there's more give and take even though there's not. But you feel more involved. You feel like you're more part of the process or part of this bigger thing than just a game, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that's at least, you know, I mean, obviously in the past people had less facility and less ability to do this sort of thing. But I think today, I mean, I think that's
really no excuse not to, really, is it?
Well, there's no excuse not to, and also it really does help give people, you know, more reason to go and continue to play your game right? And so that,
because like, especially like if you mention cool things that maybe some players will find anyway, other players will think, oh, I'll go and find that now.
Right.
Yeah. I think probably the word that you would tend to use for this kind of mentality in business would be buy-in.
Like yes.
Consumer buy-in.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You want people to care about your product, right? You want people to, because if they care, they're going to buy it. They're going to buy more of it if you're selling products, right? But in a game, you want people to continue to play your game, right? And so they can sell you more stuff down the line. You know, and I think a part of this that's important as well is it's not just a developer. It's not a one-way thing. It's a two-way thing, right? It's people feel, whether it's true or not, that they have the input back into the developers. Developers listen to what they say.
Yes.
And whether they don't have to actually do anything, but if they just acknowledge that there's a fan base out there that cares about your game and, you know, go on a forum sometime and post something about it or, you know, acknowledge something in a blog that, you know, people are asking about this. I think that really makes people, you know, much more interested that they are actually part of a community, right? They're part of, you know, the game developer understands me. He wants to make this game for me more. That we're part of something bigger part of something bigger than just a game. Everybody wants to be part of a community of some sort, right? You know, man's a social animal and they like to be part of communities. And if developers can
exploit that, I suppose.
Well, yeah.
No, yes. I don't mean that in the bad sense of the word.
That's exactly, that's a good word for that. If they can take advantage of that, if they can, leverage that and give people the sense that, yes, we are part of this, you know, Team Fortress 2 community or this Left 4 Dead community or this Morrowind community, although they didn't do a very good job of doing this back in the day, that people will continue to be interested in this game and will continue to play it. And I think that two-way communication is again very, very important for making this sort of this games with long tails, right?
Yeah.
Which is what kind of the holy grail these days of gaming is.
I suppose, like, I kind of almost touched on it then, is that kind of the downside to having all these gamers engaged with and communities engaged with the games in however way they do it, they tend to end up with a lot of entitlements, feelings of entitlements, and then there's a kind of balance between how you police the community and manage the expectations, because it kind of ends up being like a double-edged sword, doesn't it? Because it can really help you and drive your business and your game and your art form. At the same time, it can also drag you back and destroy you at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, there is definitely a fine balance there that you have to walk, you know, where people will tend to push your limits, and how you react to that will dictate how the community feels about certain things. So if you come off and somebody, you know, is a douchebag and you slap them down too hard, other people will tend not to give you the feedback that you're trying to get from them, right? And so, there is a very hard, tight line that these guys have to walk if they're going to be engaged in this sort of activity. I think also, how you accept, external content is another part of this, right? Because if you allow it and you encourage it, then I think people will become more involved. But if you discourage it or you don't care about it, then I think people will get discouraged and they won't want to play your game for as long as you would like.
No. Right?
So whether it's mod tools or allowing them to tinker around with your resources, or like in Civilization 4, putting the whole, there's a mod environment where you can, and people have made totally new games using the Civilization 4, Civilization 4 as an engine. I think that's one of the things that gives that game a long tail is, you can play the game and it's really cool, but, when you've conquered the world for the 1,000th time, you can go download Fall from Heaven 2, right? And that's a totally different game for all intents and purposes. And it's very cool that they let the people who wanted to do that sort of thing and supported them to some extent, allow them to do that. And that makes people feel good, right? And people continue to come back to this well, right? And so I think it's important. I mean, Morrowind's a good example. I don't think Bethesda encouraged it like they probably could have, but they didn't discourage it. And their fans,
they didn't stop anyone from doing it, yeah.
Right, so the fans were able to go and put up this, the site for all the mods, and people were willing to go out and spend a lot of energy. There's a lot of people with a lot of talent, who have way too much free time, who go and generate all this content on your behalf. And if you're a developer, you're silly if you don't harness that in some way.
And it's actually amazing how much they've improved, especially the visual aspects of Morrowind.
Oh yeah,
it's like pretty much as good as, if not better, as Oblivion was when it was released.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you. I mean, it's a very, some of the screenshots I've seen of some of the visual mods are impressive. And and when that game came out, it was an impressive game, right? It's just so much crisper and depth of field and color vibrancy. It's beautiful, beautiful. And that's all just people in their spare time doing, It's pretty amazing to me that that people could put that together.
Yeah.
I
think it takes a lot of patience and love as well.
Yeah, you got to really want to do that. And I played Oblivion. I like Oblivion a little bit better than I like Morrowind, just because I like the exploration aspects with, all the negatives of the game that I actually realized were there. But I played with a lot of mods, visual mods, because that game you had such far sight lines. And if you had the mods that would enable the details, it was it still is a breathtaking game in certain circumstances. And, and that's all people just, on the free time, showing their love for the game, and I think having a place to put all that stuff is important. And I wish Bethesda had, perhaps supported the community better in having their own. I mean, they did have some mod site where you could have some mods were there, but I think there are external, fan sites that have a much better collection, and are much better moderated and rated for you to go find the stuff that you want to find for those games.
Yeah.
I think they kind of missed the boat on that.
I think I'm actually probably more okay with that kind of thing, because if they're more hands-off and they allow these things to be more externalized, then there's less of a feeling of responsibility that they should be policing them. And so that can lead down to the path of not allowing certain mods, but allowing other ones, and then,
Okay, I don't disagree with that. I think you probably have a point there.
Like I said before, it's like a fine line you walk down, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, yes. And there'll be some people who are like, well, these people made this look beautiful, why didn't you? And I don't think anybody wants to go down that path.
No. I was going to say just one last game to kind of... put this point across as, do you remember Titan Quest? Diablo clone type game.
Yeah.
Like Iron Lore shut down pretty soon after the expansion pack was out.
Yeah.
And because they had mod tools released with the game, there's still a vibrant modding community, and they keep releasing new games based on the engine. And it's brilliant. It's just, I mean, I haven't played it, I haven't had time, but
they're there if I want them.
They're there when you get around to playing them. And that's very interesting. I was not aware that there was a modding community around Titan Quest, which is a really good game.
I mean, the interesting thing with Titan Quest was there was never any official forums for Titan Quest. So it was just TitanQuest.net was like some random guy's domain. And everyone ended up going there. I was there from the beginning when the demo was first released. And I was providing like tech support for the people trying to get the demo to run and stuff like that. Obviously, not by my own, but with other people as well.
Sure.
Because the game was pretty buggy when it was first released. It's amazing that people have put in the time and effort and they've created like 200 plus hours worth of games. Like with new models, new enemies, new classes, new storylines, and I think if game designing was cheaper, there'd be a lot more people out there in the profession.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. There's just such a barrier to entry to get into it. I mean, I've tried to, I've started as many games as EA, but EA's beat me on the number that they finished because I haven't finished any. Because it is, there's a high barrier to entry to get something going. No doubt. I would just say, talk about Titan Quest, it reminded me, there's a game that came out, I guess, in the last year called Torchlight.
Oh, yeah.
Diablo clone. They had a lot of mod tools. And they were doing, here's a game where I think the developers did everything right. But I don't really get a sense that there's a real community around it. Because, they did. They talked about the game. They talked about how it was done. They released mod tools. I don't know how much community feedback came back, but I haven't heard of a lot of, a lot of mods for that game, and I looked at the mod tools, and they're pretty decent.
I think there are quite a few mods, but I think they're relatively minor mods. It's not because I think the problem with Torchlight, the problem I have with Torchlight, it's a very simplistic game. It's not very deep,
right?
And
it's a rogue game. It's roguelike.
No, but it's even less deep than Titan Quest and Diablo. And even like Sacred and the other games like that. It's very, very simplified. It's a very enjoyable game.
Yeah.
But I think possibly because it's quite simplistic, fewer people have any ideas how they would want to modify that perhaps.
Right.
Because those features already exist in other games they might be already playing.
Right. Well, that's probably true. That's probably a good point. I think the other thing is the developers seem like they went quiet because they're working on their MMO.
Yes, yeah.
Maybe they didn't give enough. Because I think they released this in order to generate interest in their MMO, which I think is coming out, last I heard, at the end of this year.
Also some funding as well.
To get some funding and to prove some things, right? To prove an engine.
But
you would think that they would have kept up some sort of drumbeat, a PR, developers out talking and blogging and, you'd see more stuff out of those guys. In order to keep the interest up for their MMO, and I haven't really, and I read a lot of stuff, and you do, I know you do as well. I haven't seen a whole lot of information coming out of those guys.
Past
about a month or two after release.
Since Torchlight released, it's been pretty dead.
Yeah,
in regards, well, from the developer, I mean.
Right.
And I must have kind of, I know they didn't say they were going to do one. I kind of expected some sort of mini expansions.
Right, or some new maps, some new levels.
Yeah.
Something. Some new fish would be awesome.
Right? Yeah.
Maybe a ferret instead of a cat or a dog. I mean, just something just to keep people. Again, here's where I guess they fell down. You need to periodically release some content, I think, to keep people interested because, if people aren't going to pick up the ball and release their own content, you kind of have to do that for them and give them more, and I think it kind of feeds on itself, right? Because you release some content, people say, oh yeah, okay, I'll take this idea and meld it with my crazy idea. And now we have a really cool mod, that extends it further. And then you start to kind of pick up this momentum. And before you know it, people are making mods all the time and talking about your game. It's too bad because, always want those small companies to succeed.
Yes.
And I'm sure they sold a lot of Torchlight, and they'll probably sell a lot of their MMO. But, you know, I just wish that more people were talking about that game, because I think it's interesting and has some interesting things to say about simplistic gaming.
Yes, yeah.
Right? You know, because it is very much, it is a rogue-like game in almost its most pure sense. There's a few extra mechanics grafted on, but, you know, it very much is like rogue.
And it's more lenient, I think, as well.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's a little bit more lenient. But
I do like certain things, like, you know, the pet being able to go back to town to sell off your inventory, so you don't have to travel back yourself and stuff like that.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's pretty cool. And the town portal scrolls. And they've added some things to make it easier for you to get in and out, to not offend modern sensibilities, if you will. But still, you know, it is pretty, you know, pretty much a simple game at its core.
Yeah. That's cool. Anything else? I can't think of anything myself.
No, I think we've taken this topic and smashed it in the ground pretty hard.
Okay. Well, I think possibly you should say goodnight here, because I'm starting to lose my my wind.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think we have anything else to say. We have any news? Any podcast news?
No, I don't think so. I think it's all quiet on the Western Front. Hopefully.
Okay.
Start being a bit more regular now. I'm back in England and on a normal job, so I'll have a normal schedule each week.
Okay, cool. Well, yeah, that'll be good.
Okay, folks, thanks for listening. Have a good week, and we'll see you again next time.
Night, everybody. Talk to you later. Woo.